This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Washington. It's the news roundup. President Trump releases new federal guidelines for reopening the country in phases. He says it's up to governors and mayors to decide when to open businesses and schools based on the spread of the virus in their areas. But without additional federal funds for widespread testing, will this patchwork approach only allow the virus to spread further? The Department of Labor says 22 million Americans have filed for unemployment in the past 4 weeks, inflicting a toll on the labor force not seen since the Great Depression. But the $349 billion federal loan program intended to help small businesses during the pandemic ran out of money. Will congressional lawmakers put aside their differences and refund the Paycheck Protection Program? Joining us to talk about the week's top national stories is Michael Goldfarb. He's the host of the first Rough Draft of History podcast. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Lisa Desjardins, she's the correspondent with PBS NewsHour. Welcome back to 1A, Lisa.
Great to be here.
And David Gura, he's a correspondent with NBC News and an anchor on MSNBC. David, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Let's jump right in. On Thursday, the White House outlined a plan to reopen the economy in three phases. Lisa, tell us, what is in that plan?
Well, one of the main headlines of this plan is the president is essentially going to let governors have wide latitude for deciding what they put in place when. But this plan is three phases based on essentially whether your state has seen an increase or especially if it has seen a decrease in the number of cases over 14 days. So states that see a decrease in the cases over 14 days, the government is now recommending that in phase one, they can start allowing groups to meet in groups of under 10 people at a time. Restaurants can open with some social distancing, but in that first phase, schools would remain closed. Then phase two, if cases continue to go down in that state, schools could reopen. Of course, with some social distancing, schools would have to work out those provisions. You would see more social events. And then in phase three, you would have most things reopened, however, with continued recommendations that anyone who feels ill stays at home and that people practice increased health precautions.
Here's part of what President Trump said about the plan at the press conference Thursday.
We are not opening all at once, but one careful step at a time. And some states will be able to open up sooner than others. Some states are not in the kind of trouble that others are in.
Trump said it's up to governors and mayors to decide when to reopen their economies, reversing his assertion earlier in the week that he had total authority. David, how have governors responded to the plan so far?
Well, you heard the president there say some governors, and I think it highlights this tension that's been apparent from the very beginning here between the public health interests and the economic interests, and that's obviously something that's been really bothersome to the president as all of this has proceeded. But there are a handful of governors who look at their states and the counts of illness there, death counts there, and see themselves as doing better, I guess you could say, than some other states like the one that I'm in, New York, and want to move ahead here, see the sort of tension working out more in their favor. I think there's a lot to be determined here. And what we saw yesterday was essentially, 12, 13 pages, a slide deck from the White House and the president's advisors indicating what they want to see happen. And Lisa has ticked through that so well. But it's unclear how all of this is going to be executed yet. And this huge issue continues to be testing. And that's kind of been a through line throughout the course of this entire crisis. And certainly as the president has brought business leaders into the fold to hear what they have to say. I mean, a big story this week was he talked to a lot of CEOs who said, we really can't get back to work. We can't open up our businesses again until we know who has the disease and who doesn't. And so as much as the president talks about the fact that we're doing more testing than we had been doing, yes, that's true, but it's an issue of relativism. Until that's really righted, it's hard to execute all of this. So I think in these coming days, coming weeks, it's going to be kind of incumbent on the White House, on the president, on his advisors to give more detail, to sort of fill in some of the nuance that was missing from, again, that slide deck yesterday and the presentation that he and his advisors made.
Lisa, you heard David run through some of the things that were missing, testing being one. The president's plan did not address difficult issues such as that. Tell us more about what wasn't in the plan.
Well, that's right. Testing is one. That is the critical issue. We've heard that from corporate executives as well, but also tracing. And there is a real political debate. There's a philosophical debate about whether this country wants to do the kind of tracing that has allowed some other countries to really contain the disease and start to reopen. And in fact, a story that didn't get a lot of headlines, but is real, is that the CDC is now working with some census workers and trying to hire more to begin to do some disease tracing on behalf of this country. So that is a critical part of the plan, that it's not clear exactly how the country is going to handle. There is real disagreement on Capitol Hill over how much we should trace, when to start tracing, but that's part of the plan that was not really delineated by the president.
Lisa, just to clarify something you said earlier, you said Trump will let governors decide. Don't they decide regardless of Trump?
That's a really good catch. You're right. The president had said that he believes he has the power to essentially tell this country when it can reopen or when it can shut down. He believes he has that power. From the White House perspective, he is now not operating that power. Governors and many others, including many other Republicans, do not believe he has that power. So I think it's really more of a media battle right now than anything else.
Switching gears. Also on Thursday, we learned that 5.2 million more people filed for unemployment benefits last week, meaning more than 22 million people have lost their jobs in the last month. Michael, this is the worst unemployment situation since the Great Depression. Help us put these numbers in context.
Well, it's almost impossible to come up with because, you know, the Great Depression is almost, you know, 90 years ago. Within my lifetime, there have been two moments when there have been real spasms of unemployment. One was in the recession of 1981 and 82, and in which the numbers spiked to the levels not seen since the Great Depression. Then, of course, in 2008. And the thing that makes this 22 million, which is absolutely unprecedented, in the Great Depression, yes, at its peak, unemployment was about 25%, but it took a couple of years to build to that from the Wall Street crash of 1929 to 1932. Okay. This has happened literally overnight. The thing that's most worrisome about this is that both in 1981-82 and again in 2008, people didn't really get back to work. It took a long time for employment numbers to reach, you know, better levels or levels that were politically and economically sustainable. But people who lost their jobs went back to work with fewer protections, earning less money. And I think the best anecdotal evidence I can say is do a search and see how often the term gig economy was used before 2008. Mm. Now imagine 22 million people have been thrown out of work in 4 weeks, and imagine how long it's going to take to get them back to work and earning something like what they were earning the day they lost their jobs. And I think that even more than the disease, this is the threat that faces American society going forward.
Are these numbers then expected to get worse next week? What do you think we can expect?
I mean, there's no reason to think that that people will be hiring again. We've just been talking about the very loose outline for getting the country back to work that was put forward yesterday, you know, and it really was, as David was describing, it was just a PowerPoint presentation with nothing fixed until there's enough data gathered on the disease and its progress through the population. There's no safe way to really get things going. And then this will continue for, it doesn't seem to me possible that this employment crisis won't continue for quite a while after the disease is brought under control, because yes, people are, Paul Krugman, in fact, wrote today that he expects savings will now increase because people have no place to go and spend their money. And they're getting a little relief here and a little relief there. They'll get their unemployment checks. But nevertheless, there won't be some massive consumption binge in the autumn when we're all free to go out again. people will not be willing to go out and buy a new truck. They won't necessarily, this will be catching up. They won't go out to dinner a night or two nights a week. And so you're going to see unemployment being a very difficult situation for quite some time.
Bob emails us from Greenbelt, Maryland. When this latest stimulus bill was being debated, there was a lot of talk about Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin having $500 billion to use at his discretion. Can he use that to replenish the Paycheck Protection Program for small businesses? And we'll get more into this in a bit, Michael, but quick response there.
Well, I hesitate to be absolutely sure about anything at this moment, except the broad stroke. And I would simply add this just as one more bit of historic information. About 18 months ago on my podcast, I interviewed Angus Deaton and Ann Case, the economics professors at Princeton University, who have been studying inequality, and they coined the phrase death of despair.
Actually, Michael, why don't you hold that thought for just a second, because we want to hear that story, but I do have to take a quick pause. Still to come, the presumptive Democratic nominee for President Joe Biden received some major endorsements this week. We're speaking with Michael Goldfarb, Lisa Desjardins, and David Gura. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor LegalZoom. LegalZoom makes it easy for Americans to set up their estate plans without leaving their homes. Don't know the difference between a last will or living trust? What about an advance healthcare directive? LegalZoom can help. They're not a law firm, but you can get started quickly online and also get advice through their network of independent attorneys. Learn more about estate plans and how you can speak to an attorney for advice at LegalZoom.com.
If you're spending more time at home, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. From family-friendly favorites to stream to recommendations that will calm your nerves, we've got ideas. What to watch, what to read, what to listen to. For both old favorites and new arrivals, Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Listen and share with your friends.
This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're talking about the week's top national stories with Michael Goldfarb of the First Rough Draft of History podcast, Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour, and David Gura with NBC News and MSNBC. As promised, Michael, I want you to go ahead and finish your thought from earlier.
Just quickly, the final framing of all of this discussion about job loss, Angus Deaton and Ann Case pointed out that all of this takes place against an even more difficult background, which is we are going through an epochal change in the nature of employment. And what happened in 1981, 82, and again in 2008, is that employers use this opportunity, one, to get rid of workers, but increasingly to automate. And so there's no guarantee that the 22 million who've already filed will have jobs to go back to in the long run. And that's something that we also have to consider.
And a $349 billion small business loan program ran out of money this week. The Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program launched back on April 3rd. The SBA said more than 1.6 million loan applications were approved before it stopped accepting new applications. Lisa, can you remind us what this program is again?
Absolutely. I've been covering this closely. This program, perhaps more than any other, was the way Congress was hoping to avoid mass layoffs. About 48% of our workforce is in small businesses. So this idea was to float the payroll, to borrow a phrase from Lindsey Graham, float the payroll for small businesses for 8 weeks. This is an unprecedented program where the federal government will cover your payroll, your lease, and your utilities as much as you spend on that for 8 weeks. It starts as a loan, but it becomes a grant. And of course, this was wildly popular, especially as we saw more and more small businesses lose their business. And as you saw, the $349 billion is now completely allotted over just 14 days. For some perspective, that's as much as the Small Business Administration loaned out over the last 14 years.
Wow.
So it's an unprecedented amount of cash, but the problem is that figure that you cited of who's gotten the money, 1.6 million loans have gone out. That's a lot of loans. However, there are 30 million small businesses in this country. Mm-hmm. So it really does not address the problem. And I know dozens and dozens of small businesses that are waiting in line for these loans, don't know if they got it, are worried that they will not get it. And to speak to the unemployment figures Michael was talking about, you asked, will they go up next week?
Yeah.
I feel that this program freezing will be part of those unemployment numbers going up. These small businesses were waiting for this money, hoping to keep their employees on the payroll. Most of them now are not getting it.
David, is there more money coming?
So many small businesses hope that that's the case.
Yeah.
So much of this policy was targeted to sort of keep intact so much as the government could these connections between employers and those employees who were laid off. That's really what the design of the fiscal policy was for. They would love nothing more than to have more of this money available to them. I mean, Lisa brings up that statistic. There are so many small businesses wanting for this money. And, you know, a tension that I've been looking at a lot this week is between how quickly this needs to happen, how time is of the essence, and then also just how long it takes for these things to play out customarily. So how important that policy is as a result of that. We've seen the deliberations on Capitol Hill, how this has become political with Republicans saying Democrats are unwilling to pass legislation that would just increase the size of the pot or what would be available for lenders to give to small businesses. Democrats making other demands on how that money would be allocated. I think that the more that continues, the more dispirited small business owners are going to get. Every economist I talk to talks about the overriding sense of urgency that needs to happen at this point. And the more that this gets bogged down in that kind of political morass, the more it's going to be dispiriting and the more that it's going to lead perhaps to catastrophic results for these small businesses. I'll say one thing just in light of what the president was saying yesterday. I mean, he was speaking so much about the economy reopening. And as I heard that, I wondered about the likelihood that there is going to be more money allocated here. If his hope is and his expectation is that the economy is going to flip back on and things are going to improve once again, I just wonder if that's going to resonate poorly with lawmakers who think that maybe the need for this program isn't going to be as acute as it was just a few days or a few weeks ago. I think that would be incredibly worrisome to a lot of small business owners.
And people around the country began receiving those $1,200 stimulus deposits in their bank accounts this week. And those who don't have bank information on file, the IRS is sending the money via check. Lisa, tell us quickly, what was that deal with the name on the check? Because that caused a delay, right?
Well, you know, there's been, I don't have this reporting personally, but the Washington Post and I believe others are reporting that the president did mention at some point to the Treasury Secretary the idea that his name could be on the check. By federal law, that's not allowed. But instead, we understand that his name will accompany the check in some form. These are paper checks only. Other people are getting it by direct deposit. This will be the first time ever that the president's name, we'll see what the form looks like exactly, has accompanied a disbursement from the IRS to taxpayers.
Interesting. Now let's get to some of the politics around coronavirus this week. Let's start with a move President Trump made on Tuesday.
Today, I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess the World Health Organization's role in severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus. Everybody knows what's going on there.
You're back in the hot seat, Lisa. The president cut U.S. funding to a United Nations special agency focused on public health during the worst public health crisis in a century. What's been the global response?
Well, there's been real concern globally. The United States is the largest contributor to the World Health Fund, the World Health Organization, and it is an important contributor, always has been a leading contributor. And without that money, especially in developing countries, there could be a real problem. There are questions on Capitol Hill. Democrats have questioned if he legally can pull back this money, but it gets very complicated quickly. There are two different pots of money. One is the fees that are assessed every year for the United States. Democrats say the U.S. must pay those fees. The White House seems to disagree. Then there is a voluntary contribution, which is much more, that the U.S. also gives the WHO. There seems to be general agreement that the president can withhold that voluntary money if he wants. So we have to see exactly how this works. There is real concern on Capitol Hill and around the world that right now, whatever the questions are about the World Health Organization, which both parties have, it's not the time to cut funding in the middle of a pandemic. However, the president feels differently.
Why did the president make this move, David?
Well, you know, there has been percolating for a while now suspicion in some circles that China was not forthcoming about how this virus began. And as Lisa's saying, I think that there is a desire among both parties, among everyone, to pinpoint what exactly happened in China where this disease first came about. You know, I think there's an element of that, him sort of succumbing to that scuttlebutt about what could have happened and did the WHO do its job. I think another part of this is just the president's kind of historic distaste for, dislike for multinational organizations and his lack of an appetite for contributing the sums that the U.S. has been contributing to those groups. I mean, I think what's interesting about this moment, and Lisa was alluding to this, is this is an organization, the WHO, that at this very moment is involved in sophisticated work looking at this virus, looking at potential vaccines for this virus, doing really good and important work as all of this progresses, as that organization was designed to do. Is this the time for us to be taking a retrospective look at what happened here? In other words, stop or forestall what they're doing to have this small crisis, this small political crisis about funding, you know, perhaps have these conversations a bit later. But I think what we're hearing from world leaders, what we're hearing from public health leaders as well, is that group does incredibly important work. Let's not ignore the fact that there may have been some problems here. But again, this isn't the time. This likely isn't the time to sort of create the small tempest that's going to that might preclude them from doing what they need to be doing at this point in time.
I'm talking with David Gura from NBC News, Lisa Desjardins from the PBS NewsHour, and Michael Goldfarb, host of the First Rough Draft of History podcast. Michael, let's talk about the domestic political fallout. How are Democrats pushing back against this move by the president legally and legislatively?
Well, certainly legislatively, they've tied up. Tied up is infelicitous. They have been holding, as we've been talking about, trying to get greater clarity about how the Small Business Administration will disperse these personal paycheck guarantee loans, and that's important. In other respects, I'm not entirely sure. Most of the political news at the moment coming from the Democratic Party, it seems to me, and remember that I'm at a distance from Washington, is, you know, they're finally trying to get some forward movement in their own presidential nominating process. In terms of, you know, for example, the WHO, I just to go back there for a second, I haven't seen any Democrats, congressional Democrats, making the point that, you know, throughout this crisis, the president has been selecting groups to be the whipping boy of the week. At one point, it was the Chinese government directly. It's the Chinese virus. His approval ratings went up amongst his supporters, certainly. Then it's the press. His approval ratings go up. Now it's the WHO because he can tie them to China. And I haven't seen any Democrats yet. And I'm sure that David and Lisa may have knowledge of individuals who've had, pointing out the fact that, you know, whatever the WHO's position, the intelligence services of the United States were briefing the president long before we even knew the words mm-hmm. coronavirus or COVID-19. So it's not really for the WHO to be taking the lead. It's for the president and his advisors and those who receive those intelligence briefings
right.
to be speaking up about.
Okay, so President Trump now is enlisting the help of business leaders to speed up the opening of the U.S. economy. Washington Post reported that the plan got off to a rocky start this week, with many corporate executives pushing the White House to focus more on mass testing. So here comes that word again, Lisa. Trump has said mass testing isn't necessary to reopen the country. Do we know if these business leaders were able to change his mind?
We don't know yet. And I have to say, in covering this president, you know, it could change day to day, too. We could have a statement that goes one way and a statement that goes the other way. And this is why it's a very big problem that Congress is not meeting, cannot meet essentially right now, because there what already was a political leadership vacuum that this country's had for some time is now a literal leadership vacuum with the president kind of, he is the president, that is his job to be the executive. However, there are not as many voices from Congress that can lead. There are proposals for mass testing bills. There are ideas in Congress, but they just can't have any momentum because Congress is technically not meeting right now.
Democratic congressional leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer had a couple meetings this week with the Treasury Department. This comes as Congress is rushing to pass a second coronavirus relief package. David, what are the provisions Democrats are trying to get into this bill?
Yeah, Democrats are trying to fortify the safety net kind of underpinning the economy so much as it can at this point in time. I was speaking just a little while ago about that particular Paycheck Protection Act and how there was the goal of that, the Payroll Protection Program, rather, was, you know, something that Democrats didn't want to see raised without other things added to it. I imagine Lisa's more specific, more familiar with the specific provisions of it, but I know that something Democrats want is just a lot more support for those who've been marginalized by what's happened here. Want to make sure that this isn't just something that is hand-tailored for that program. You know, I think something of interest this week is just sort of the breakdown in communication between the Democratic leadership and the White House, and this has been a story that's gone on for many months now. But in this crisis, we've seen once again that there is no regular communication between the House Speaker and the President of the United States, and that's something that in an interview this week she downplayed. She said that every time there is a meeting between someone in her position and the President of the United States, it's an historic meeting. It's incredibly important. But I think it's fair to say that in a crisis like that, you would want to see, you would expect to see there more regular dialogue and communication. Now, there has been that between the Treasury Secretary and the Speaker. I think that that's kind of, if you're looking for bright lights here and sort of bright spots here in the way that this crisis has unfolded, that has become a fairly successful conduit, maybe in an unexpected way. I remember early on as that first fiscal bill was being hammered out, the deputy press secretary, deputy chief of staff to the House Speaker was indicating how often those two leaders were on the phone with one another. I think it was like in one day, up to 20 or 30 times. So, you know, I think that engenders some optimism that these conversations continue at that level. But as we've seen time and time again with this administration, the president can pivot pretty quickly. And just going back to what you were talking about a moment ago, the president talking to business leaders.
Yeah.
There was just such an astonishing moment I don't want us to forget when the president had that briefing in the Rose Garden this week. And he just began to read from a list of executives of Fortune 500 companies. And my colleagues at NBC have reported just how astonished and surprised so many of those executives and their colleagues were to see those names listed. We had been told that there was going to be this second coronavirus task force or council focused on the economy announced Tuesday of this week. That never came to pass. And instead, there was this thing that was kind of created out of whole cloth by the White House, these groups that would be advising the president. That led to some conference calls this week. But I think it just highlights a bit of a breakdown here between the president and a group that he'd kind of relied on in the past, and that business leaders whom he knew and those who he's respected. He wasn't able to make that group come together in a way that he promised he would.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Now, it's not uncommon these days to have a side gig, but you wouldn't expect the president of the United States to have one. We will talk about that a little bit more in just a moment. But first, some celebrities and wealthy individuals are being roasted for tone-deaf posts on social media showing them quarantining in lavish surroundings. Billionaire entertainment executive David Geffen, for instance, posted a photo of his yacht on Instagram as he waits out the pandemic. Well, musician John Mayer wrote a song a few weeks ago mocking the post. While the parody song doesn't mention anyone by name, Mayer explained to his fans in a recent live concert online what inspired him to come up with the song.
David Geffen, who posted an Instagram photo of himself on his boat, saying he was isolated in the Grenadines. And I gotta tell you, I don't know where the Grenadines are. The most offensive thing to me about this post is assuming that I know where the Grenadines are. And I don't know where the Grenadines are.
Here's some of Mayer's song, Drone Shot of My Yacht. More from our guests and from you in just a moment. Stay with us.
450 feet, six or seven decks. You can try to stretch your neck and see all this stuff around me. I don't give a heck, cause I got a drone shot on my yacht. It's all I got. I'm all alone on the water. Drone shot on my yacht. It's all I got. I'm all alone on the water.
In the United States, Black people as a whole have less access to good health care, to education, and job opportunities than other groups. But who do we even mean when we say Black people? Who counts as Black? It's a question this country has been trying to answer from the very beginning. Listen on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
We're talking about the week's top headlines with Michael Goldfarb of the First Rough Draft of History podcast, Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour, and David Gura with NBC News and MSNBC. Now, as I mentioned before, side gigs, not uncommon these days, but you wouldn't expect the president of the United States to have one. The New York Times reported this week that President Trump pitched the idea of hosting a talk radio show to take live calls from Americans wanting information about coronavirus. He ultimately backed away from that idea. He decided he didn't want to compete with conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh. Switching gears, one industry being hit hard by coronavirus is meatpacking. Facilities across the country are seeing a spike in cases. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the CDC is investigating one of the largest outbreaks in the country. A Smithfield Foods meatpacking plant has at least 644 cases. Michael, what's going on there?
Well, this is the way the disease works. It comes in clusters. And because there's no way of testing every American, but there isn't enough testing of enough Americans, you find that if one person is exposed and goes into, this is why we socially isolate ourselves, goes into an environment to work, then he can be spreading the disease exponentially across a single 8-hour shift. And this is what happened in South Dakota. How it got to South Dakota? Well, we were talking earlier in the hour about working backwards. Census takers going out and asking people where they've been on behalf of the CDC. That's how it starts. And I think there'll be clusters like this in other places for a while.
Now, something you may not have missed these last few weeks was the sound of traffic. That's what it sounded like outside of Michigan's Capitol building Wednesday morning. Detroit News reporter Beth LeBlanc took the video of thousands of cars with homemade signs and honking horns to protest that state's stay-at-home order. The honking lasted 8 hours. David, what was the protest all about?
Yeah, these took place in Lansing, and there was a lot of frustration, as you said, just about the stay-at-home order that's been put in place in Michigan by the Democratic governor of that state, Gretchen Whitmer, who has defended that order. And so you had members of these two big groups, the Michigan Conservative Coalition and the Michigan Freedom Fund, showing up in their cars to honk and to protest. Some got out of their cars, and there was a lot of concern just about that, the lack of respect for social distancing as a result of all of this. But it goes back to what we were talking about at the top of the show. Again, I think this tension between the public health worry and the economic concern a lot of people have. I'm unclear sort of where this leads. I think it was dramatic, from where I sit. It is a treat in a way to be doing this show sort of barefooted from my apartment, and that's possible in part by the fact that there really is no traffic here in Brooklyn where I live, and that's been one of the eeriest things of this entire crisis is just how quiet New York City has been. So that contrast is really stark, and I think that's one of the ways that protest was sort of made effective or made noticeable, just the stark contrast that we had there. But you asked earlier in the show just about the degree to which governors have been talking to the president about this and expressing their concern. I think you have that. You have some Republican governors who have been saying to the president their states are open or ready to open, as the president said. Then you have a Democratic governor like Gretchen Whitmer, whose profile has been raised in these recent weeks, really standing fast and going back to the conversation that we had about meatpacking facilities.
Yeah.
Things seem fine until they aren't. And I think that that's going to be so interesting and so important to follow here in these coming weeks is, there's going to be this push to reopen things. I have this fear that some businesses will open and then someone will get sick and then that'll cause panic and another person will get sick and the business will close. I think there's a real risk here that we enter kind of a vicious cycle as a result of this push to reopen businesses. And I think that's going to be, again, something to really pay attention to.
I think a lot of people share that fear that you just mentioned. You also mentioned New York, face masks are now required to ride the subway or walk on a crowded sidewalk in New York City, even to enter a store in Maryland or New Jersey. Lisa, should we expect more states to implement orders like that?
I think that's right. But I think what you've been getting at during this broadcast is that it is different in rural areas, which are not seeing as many cases yet.
Right.
And then it will be in more urban and suburban areas. But that's right. I think even here in now the Virginia suburbs, also happy that I can sit here and do this in jeans with you over the phone.
Right. Because normally you would be right across from me here in the studio.
That's right. But we even here, grocery stores are requiring masks now, those kinds of things. And I want to just add one note about the meat packers and the meat industry in this country. Something people has not gotten enough attention is that cattle producers in particular, but also the hog industry as well, has seen a very strange plummet in prices to get their animals to market. And that might seem strange, but one of the reasons is that processing plants have been shutting down. So they're having trouble getting the beef processed on the front end, even as there is increased demand on the back end. So they're sort of getting it from both sides. And farmers are having a really difficult time in some areas. Prices are stabilizing a little bit in the last week. But as an example, we've seen sort of the lowest amount of sales of cattle in 10 years, or one of the second lowest. So it's a very significant shift in that industry right now.
But there may be some hope. Earlier this week, we spoke with Dr. Ken Davis, the CEO of New York's Mount Sinai Health System.
We've definitely reached a peak. We're coming off that peak. We're plateauing. And the question for us is the rate of decline. When will it really become quite noticeable? But we definitely feel that we've turned the corner here.
David, is the worst over for New York?
Everyone here hopes that that's the case, and we listen raptly to the governor every day when he has a press conference and shows the latest figures and shows that curve. I think there was some hope earlier this week that that was ticking down, and then it ticked up once again. So we're still riding it, but yeah, you hear from Ken Davis, you hear from other health experts, including the head of surgery at Columbia University, who writes a very good note to his colleagues that's been published publicly every day, that things may have stabilized somewhat. And as the president noted in his remarks yesterday, there were so many facilities that were created here in New York to deal with this crisis that haven't been used. And I think we're all in agreement that that's a good thing, that those temporary beds at the Javits Center, the convention center here in New York City haven't been used. That said, I think people are still collectively holding their breath. And, you know, you mentioned masks. It was amazing to see how quickly people made masks, found masks. Mm-hmm. And as you walk around my neighborhood, you see
they're everywhere.
It's now an exception to see somebody without them. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the governor yesterday said that, you know, we're going to go to May 15th and see what happens then. He doesn't want to forecast beyond that. My sense living here, my sense from talking to people here, is that the situation hasn't changed in that regard. People are still very much on guard and worried and wondering about what's going to happen. And talking to my friends who are doctors in emergency rooms across the country, I have a few of them, you know, they tell me that their concern hasn't ebbed at all. Mm-hmm. And while there might not be the sort of flood of demand that they expected or feared, this is still a really grievous problem and one that could get worse. So again, I think people are really still on guard here in New York and elsewhere.
Yeah. Switching gears, the New York Times published a story Sunday reporting a sexual assault allegation against presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Former Biden aide Tara Reid described the assault in a podcast in late March. Lisa, what did the New York Times find in its investigation of this allegation?
All right. Lisa Laird, I think they spent over 2 weeks working on this story. And in the end, they leave the conclusions to the readers. They did find that Tara Reid had two contemporaneous friends of hers, people that she knew, who confirmed that she passed on some details of this story at the time to them. Now, Tara Reid, this is a bit complicated. It might need time to unpack it at a different date. But Tara Reid initially last year said that while she worked for the vice president, then Senator Biden, that, you know, he touched the back of her neck, that he essentially made her uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But she said that it didn't go past that. Then in the past month, she's now come out with public accusations that are much more serious, basically saying that he forced her up against a wall, that even as she resisted, that he essentially inappropriately used his fingers with her genitals, and that it is now an accusation of sexual assault.
Okay.
So apparently one anonymous person has confirmed that she said a story like this. Another has confirmed the New York Times that she said something traumatic happened. Those are anonymous sources, however. The Biden campaign says that the inconsistencies in her stories show that it's not true. They say they're being very careful here. They're saying that accusers should be heard, but they're saying that this story does not pass muster. Again, it's worth reading the entire New York Times profile and looking into it, but they do not seem to draw hard conclusions here. They just lay out what they found.
So, Michael, does something like this go away?
For Joe Biden?
For Joe Biden.
It's really hard to say. The fact that it breaks in the middle of the pandemic, when this is all we're really talking about, if you're just going to be nakedly political about it, you'd say, well, then better now than any other time. And I also think that if this had happened in 2016, if he had challenged Hillary Clinton, as I believe he wanted to, it might have been more important. I don't know. I think that you just have to look at the bigger pictures of what the politics are going to be in the autumn. Unless there's something a lot more here, I don't know that this will have a lasting effect, except out there in right-wing talk radio land, where people will be discussing the hypocrisy of liberals and Me Too, and yet they've got a sexual harasser topping their ticket.
Hmm. While we're on the campaign trail, we should note that Biden racked up some big endorsements this week. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and President Barack Obama.
Joe has the character and the experience to guide us through one of our darkest times and heal us through a long recovery. And I know he'll surround himself with good people. Experts, scientists, military officials who actually know how to run the government and care about doing a good job running the government.
How much do these endorsements matter, Lisa? We heard a little bit of snark from Obama there, too.
Yeah. And first of all, that was this week. That feels like so long ago, the way these weeks are
working. I know, right?
But they matter a great deal. Obviously, we've known for some time that it was almost impossible for Bernie Sanders to overcome the momentum and the delegate gap that Joe Biden had. So it might not change the outcome so much as it's very important for two reasons. One, Biden needs that base to be electric. He needs the Sanders people and he needs the Obama people to really be excited and come out in November, maybe more than any others. Elizabeth Warren is probably the next person that he needs with the most kind of passionate base. The other reason is he needs to find a way to be kind of part of the news. And it's been hard for him to get that footing in this crisis because he does not have a leadership position now. And he's tried to have, he cannot hold rallies. Mm-hmm. But this was a way for him to show at least political strength within the Democratic Party and to get some attention.
David, Senators Sanders and Warren previously battled Biden for the nomination. Do you think their endorsements will sway their supporters? What did they say?
I think it's likely that Bernie Sanders coming out the way that he did, differently than he did back in 2016, is important. Picking up on what Lisa was saying, I mean, you just can't help but do the counterfactual. Just imagine how this would have played out if we didn't have what's happening now taking place, the kind of rallies that we would have seen the Biden campaign try to engineer with Senator Bernie Sanders or Senator Elizabeth Warren, who held out for so long before she offered her endorsement, or former President Barack Obama. I mean, that was the crown jewel and something that he held on to, held back on delivering for a really long while. These would have been huge events in public spaces with a lot of people. I'm not sure that the resonance is commensurate when these videos come out. Yes, a lot of people watched that video of President Obama, but I'm skeptical that it had the same effect that it would have if this had been in person at a big event. I do think that what it shows, having these three leaders, party leaders, come out and do this, is that the party is coalescing around Joe Biden. And yes, there'll be some squabbling around the edges about, is there enough alignment among the beliefs of Senator Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden? I think that we heard good things. Democrats heard good things about the fact that Senator Sanders' advisors and supporters are being involved in conversations about certain policy positions.
Yeah.
But it's certainly different, that's for sure.
So much to look for in these coming weeks and months. We've been talking with Michael Goldfarb. He's the host of the First Rough Draft of History podcast. Lisa Desjardins, she's a correspondent with the PBS NewsHour, and David Gura, correspondent with NBC News and an anchor on MSNBC. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. We wouldn't be on the air without our amazing engineers. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with help from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphries is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from KBucksbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Washington. It's the international section of our news roundup. Before we introduce our panel, a quick snapshot from around the world. Wuhan, where the virus emerged, has revised its death toll up to just under 4,000. That's an increase of 50%. China says it has not been involved in a cover-up, but French President Emmanuel Macron just joined those questioning China's handling of the outbreak. Much of Sweden remains open. On Monday, Denmark will allow certain businesses to reopen, including dentists, driving schools, and hair salons. And all told, there have now been more than 2 million confirmed cases worldwide and 145,000 deaths due to coronavirus. That's the big picture. But to dig in deeper, let's welcome back to the roundup Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Nina, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Tamkin is here and sporting a shiny new title. Emily is now the U.S. editor for The New Statesman. Emily, congrats on your new job.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me today.
And in New York, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan. Dan is the executive editor for Foreign Affairs and the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Now, Microsoft's co-founder Bill Gates described the President Trump's decision this week to halt funding for the World Health Organization, quote, as dangerous as it sounds. The international agency is just the latest target and comes after what's best described as mixed signals from the commander-in-chief. Daniel, I'll start with you. President Trump is cutting the money the U.S. sends to the WHO for at least 60 days. Can he do that?
So there is some dispute about how much of this money he controls and how much of it Congress is able, has already appropriated and is thus able to send against his wishes. But stepping back a bit, in some ways, this is less about the WHO than it is for Washington about China and the way that the U.S.-China competition has become really the defining dynamic of geopolitics and of U.S. foreign policy. So when Trump is complaining about the WHO, what he really wants to get at is his frustration with China and its handling of the virus in its early stages.
So that's why he's doing it. Nina, what impact could this have on the WHO?
Well, I think it's probably worth separating the WHO's record as an institution, the global impact of its work, its objective value as an international entity, whether it's properly equipped to lead the global fight against COVID-19, and separating all of that from, as Dan says, the motives that are currently propelling President Trump. I mean, I think it's worth remembering the WHO is not a government. It can't rule countries, but it can guide and coordinate. In the early days of this outbreak, when the world thought we were only dealing with China, the WHO arguably moved much faster than governments to identify the threat of contagion. But it's true that for those of us that were covering those early days, it was definitely mystifying, very striking that there was never any criticism for China's handling of the outbreak. And we kept thinking, you know, given how little we know, why is China coming in for so much praise? Wouldn't it be wise to show a little bit of caution? Mm-hmm. There are big questions over China's transparency. And I think we get a very blurred picture on whether or not this is going to have immediate ramifications, because there's still not very much detail from the White House in terms of what it's planning to do. We've got this 60 to 90 day review period. Clearly, if the US also stops its voluntary contributions to specific programs, then we may see a significant blow to the global leadership role played by the WHO. But I think there are big questions.
Nina, the WHO has been attacked, particularly from the right, as being far too easy on China. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, I have to say that, again, from the very early days of the Wuhan outbreak, those of us that were covering the WHO, I think we did wonder why it was that the WHO was so sympathetic towards China, given its previous record of burying figures, especially around SARS and HIV and previous outbreaks. So I don't think it's unfair to question the WHO's political preference for China in the early days. It did seem to be sidling up to China. And I think now, with the release of this Wuhan recount, in which they've pushed the figures up by a neat sort of 50%, that's definitely raising eyebrows.
Michael writes to us in an email, please have your panel comment on the WHO's treatment of China. To maintain its relationship with China, the WHO has to tread a very fine line, only seeking permitted information and complying with Chinese restrictions, especially regarding Taiwan. Emily, did you want to address that?
I mean, thank you for the email, Michael. And it's a fair point, again, that China's misidentified whether or not this virus could spread via human transition. Certainly, there was this sort of viral interview with a WHO official regarding, where he kind of skirted questions on Taiwan. But I think it's really important just to drive home for readers, or sorry, for listeners, that that the WHO is not the reason that Trump is attacking the WHO. Trump's own mishandling of this pandemic is the reason that he's attacking the WHO. The United States and South Korea, this is almost like a tired thing to point out at this point, but the US and South Korea reported their first case on the same day to the WHO. Trump spent the following month downplaying the threat of the virus. South Korea spent the following month doing test and trace, and we can now see where the two countries are. So it's, yes, sure, we can talk about the WHO, we can talk about multilateral institutions in China, we can talk about the role that Trump pulling America back from these institutions plays as well. But I think that it's important not to lose sight of, as my co-panelists have said, the transparent degree to which this is Trump playing politics with a pandemic.
Okay, let's move on to Italy. One of the first global epicenters of the coronavirus. This week, the European Union issued an apology for not doing enough to help Italy at the early stages of its outbreak. Here's what EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said at a parliamentary debate on Thursday.
Yes, it is true that no one was really ready for this. It is also true that too many were not there on time when Italy needed a helping hand at the very beginning. And yes, for that, it is right that Europe as a whole offers a heartfelt apology. But saying sorry only counts for something if it changes behavior.
Emily, how exactly did the EU fail Italy?
I mean, the EU, like much of the rest of the world, was slow to realize the degree to which this was a problem. And so Italy, which was so hard hit early on at the beginning, did not have the resources it needed from this union, which is meant to sort of, which is meant in part to step in and support the various nation states of which it is comprised. But I think it should be noted now that although the EU, they are sharing PPE between countries, there are doctors traveling between countries, an apology itself is going to be woefully insufficient if the EU does not figure out a financial solution to this. And at the moment, Italy is asking for shared debt relief, right, either in the form of euro bonds or corona bonds. And Germany, in particular, has said no, that they do not support that, and have sort of promised that they'll come up with some other solution. Unless that solution is dramatic and progressive and adopted rather soon, the sorry is going to ring very hollow, I would think, to Italians, among others, in Europe.
Nina, against the backdrop of Brexit, is this another sign that the EU project is struggling at the moment?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Brexit, and I couldn't agree more with Emily. It really is a case of too little, too late. I noticed today that Italy has accepted the EU's apology, but one poll is showing 88% of Italians feel very let down. And it seems to have taken an epic crisis of epic proportions for the EU to give this rather late in the day apology. And it's something that a lot of certainly my Italian friends have been warning about for weeks, even months, that that backlash against the EU was likely to come soon and swiftly. And frankly, as Emily says, the real battle is now about to hit Europe very hard. That's over the EU's next seven-year budget. EU finance ministers have agreed on a 500 billion euro rescue package. Mm-hmm. The Italian government says it won't sign any plan that doesn't include shared debt among EU nations, and we're beginning to see EU solidarity basically fall apart. And this is after the EU mocked, vilified, and really disregarded UK sentiment about leaving over Brexit.
And, you know, you mentioned EU solidarity, but is it fair to say that there's a growing anti-EU feeling in Italy?
I think certainly anecdotal evidence is showing and, you know, some polling that Italians feel very frustrated with the EU. And I think we shouldn't forget the human side of this. I mean, Italy is cautiously, optimistically, but painfully coming back to life, opening its businesses, putting livelihoods gradually back on track. It's obviously, you know, not out of a very painful and traumatic episode. And to have the EU kind of apologize when, in fact, the real question is how financially is this European solidarity going to come together? It's not just about political statements. It's about the financial backing and how the EU copes with the severity. I mean, the real way out of this crisis is actually going to be from massive spending by individual governments, mm-hmm. Spending on their own economic problems. So I think that solidarity is going to be very elusive.
We've talked about the EU and the WHO. Let's talk about the UN. Members of the United Nations Security Council are trying to rally support for a global ceasefire due to the coronavirus. French President Emmanuel Macron said this week that he supports the plan and is hopeful that he can get Russia to agree as well. Daniel, what's this all about?
So this started in March when the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, called for this immediate global ceasefire. And it's, in one sense, been gaining momentum over the past few weeks. You have various world leaders declaring their support for this global ceasefire. But at the same time, it comes amidst this tussle over WHO, the sniping between the United States and China, all of which is a reminder that in many ways, these competitive dynamics, this disarray in the system is much stronger than these better angels, even when those better angels do try to whip into action. And what's more, with the conflicts that are really playing out in the world today, they're not conflicts that are being ordered by global leaders in capitals in Beijing or Washington or Moscow or Paris. They're playing out on the ground in very complicated ways. So even when you have leaders saying that fighting should stop or war should stop, that doesn't mean that the antagonists on the ground are going to agree. So you had, for example, Saudi Arabia saying it and its allies would stop fighting in Yemen. But very quickly, those fighting on the ground said they weren't going to obey that ceasefire. So even with this international action, this move towards some kind of global accord during this time of crisis, it's unlikely to have the effect on the ground that these leaders wanted to have.
Emily, Russia isn't yet on board?
That's correct. Macron said yesterday in an interview that he believes that Putin will sign on. The Russian diplomat, his spokesperson Peskov, I believe, put out just the most Russian diplomatic statement, which was, oh, our diplomats need to discuss and see how this will work before we can join. But as Daniel says, you know, Russia doesn't necessarily have control over every proxy that Russia has backed throughout, like the United States, right, does not necessarily have that sort of control over the people who are actually waging war right now. And further, I think it's important to note that Russia, again, like other countries, does not necessarily own up to the times that it does break treaties and agreements. So you have, like, Russia still hasn't admitted that it was behind the attempted murder of Skripal in the UK. It hasn't said that it was responsible for the downing of MH17 over Ukraine. So It's fine for Macron to hope that Russia signs on. It's fine for Russia to sign on. This is not an unworthy endeavor. But as Daniel says, these world leaders don't necessarily have control over the people who are actually waging violence in the world. And second, they can sign the agreement. It doesn't mean that they'll abide by it.
Let's put the focus more on some of the world's top individuals and assess how they've responded to the crisis. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern made this announcement on Wednesday.
Today, I can confirm that myself, government ministers, and public service chief executives will take a 20% pay cut for the next 6 months, as we acknowledge New Zealanders who are reliant on wage subsidies, taking pay cuts and losing their jobs as a result of COVID-19's global pandemic.
Ardern has also been praised for her response to the coronavirus outbreak. That's included a month-long shutdown starting March 25th to April 4th. On April 4th, New Zealand saw a consecutive drop in cases. Nina, why has she gotten so much praise?
Well, there's a separate conversation about female leadership. Supposedly the most competent countries are being led by women, Germany, Finland, New Zealand. We just heard her, as you mentioned there in that clip, that she took a 20% pay cut. What's interesting is that she also shamed the opposition leader into taking one too. What's interesting about Jacinda Ardern is that she's a rising star internationally, but her domestic image until this crisis, she wasn't universally liked. She emerged from a hung parliament situation. But she is getting laudits for the way in which she's been very much in touch with the nation. She's been very practical, down to earth. I don't know if you've seen her fireside chats, which when she suddenly announced this four-week lockdown, I mean, she's been doing them on Facebook and she's there in her sweatpants taking questions from the public. I mean, you really can't imagine a figure like Boris Johnson or President Trump doing something like that. She's also championed the poor and she got the New Zealand banks to give people a six-month mortgage holiday. The other innovative thing about New Zealand, which is worth mentioning, is that the word bubble has come into the lexicon. They've developed the system where essentially you move within your family bubble as your primary bubble, and then you have your work bubble, and you don't step outside those bubbles, which really allows for much more accurate contact tracing. So they've had something like 11 deaths for 5 million people, very low, which by contrast, Australia is much more of a microcosm of the US, a lot of skepticism and delay in the beginning. New Zealand really got its act together.
Emily, is New Zealand the new Norway? If you know what I mean, it strikes many as doing more things right than wrong.
I mean, I do know what you mean. I think that in their handling of this crisis, sure, they can be the new Norway. But I think that what's important to note for American listeners, because we'll see clips of Jacinda Ardern online of her like talking about how maybe the Easter Bunny can't come to kids' houses this year, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't care about them, you know, and being very warm and relatable. And it's, I think it's sort of easy to just see those viral moments over here and not put them in context. It's the same with Leo Varadkar in Ireland, he's a doctor and he's going back to work. And but the reason these leaders are getting praise is not for these sort of one-offs, right? It's exactly as Nina said, because they were very aggressive in realizing that this was serious, in testing, in tracing. And so these sort of human moments help their image. But all of the Easter Bunny and being a doctor in the world wouldn't, I don't think, have done much good if they had not really risen to the occasion that this pandemic presented.
I'm talking with Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, Nina Maria Potts, director of global news coverage for Feature Story News, and Daniel Kurtzphalen, executive editor of Foreign Affairs. Now, someone else being rewarded for how he had handled this moment is South Korea's President Moon Jae-in. His governing party won parliamentary elections by a landslide on Wednesday. It was the first time in 16 years that left-leaning parties have won a majority in parliament. Now, Daniel, can this landslide victory for Moon Jae-in be attributed to the way his administration has handled coronavirus?
To a certain extent, that's true. South Korea is in many ways emerging as the real model of what a good response looks like. It learned, as I think Emily pointed out earlier, of first cases around the time the U.S. did, and it moved much more quickly to do things like ramp up testing. So it started testing lots and lots of people very, very quickly. It used technology. in very adept ways to do contact tracing to see who had interacted with other people who might have been infected. So it has become the model of how other countries should respond. And President Moon has gotten a fair degree of credit for that. And it's worth pointing out that South Korea, unlike some of the other cases that are held up in East Asia, is a democracy. So it's seen as, in some ways, a more useful model for countries like the United States or places in Europe that are affected. And that will redound to Moon's benefit, just as it's going to redound to other leaders' benefits when they move to respond to the crisis in smart and adept and quick ways. This is really kind of a test of who these leaders are. As my colleague, the Council on Foreign Relations, Tom Boyke, says, plagues tell us who we are. So you see all of these leaders really, you see their core characteristics really coming through more clearly than ever right now.
And Emily, voter turnout for this election was also the highest it's been for a parliamentary election in almost 30 years. Any idea why?
I mean, I am not a South Korean politics expert, so I sort of hesitate to speculate, but one could see it as a sort of mandate on how well the government has done.
Daniel, feel free to weigh in here on the voter turnout.
I would just say one of the things that is important about the election that just took place in South Korea is that it gives us an example of how an election can unfold smoothly and be managed effectively during a time of pandemic. So as we look ahead to additional primaries in the United States and potentially a November presidential election taking place with some lockdown still in place or some degree of social distancing still in place, the steps that South Korea took to ensure that you couldn't just have an election but have it go smoothly and have turnout rise really should be a model that we should be paying close attention to.
Okay, let's get some good news from the UK.
I've today left hospital after a week in which the NHS has saved my life, no question. It's hard to find words to express my debt.
A grateful and healthier British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was discharged from the hospital on Sunday after contracting COVID-19. Johnson spent 3 nights in intensive care. Nina, while people are, of course, relieved that Johnson has recovered, some have pointed out that though he's doing better, the country he's leading is not.
That's a very good point. There's been some degree of irritation among Boris critics that his health became the story and not the exploding death rate. Mm-hmm. That said, he's still in recovery. It did seem genuinely to be touch and go when he was admitted very abruptly into hospital and then, as you say, into intensive care. Members of his team also got sick. Matt Hancock, the Minister of Health, and also the country's chief medical officer. He has said in the last 24 hours that the UK is nearing the peak, but is not past it yet. I mean, Boris's condition was definitely both dramatic and alarming. Boris haters were very worried even about the prospect of losing the prime minister. So it did unify the country momentarily, but the UK government's response has been very controversial, as you know. I mean, there's been a huge debate in the UK about why the government was so cautiously optimistic at the beginning, this discussion over herd immunity, the delay in locking down, then the surge in infections and cases and deaths. It's all prompted a much more aggressive line of attack from the opposition. It's just extended the lockdown to another three weeks. So there's still very tough guidelines in place. And there has also been this scandal, this mess over the $20 million that they spent on Chinese testing kits, which was supposedly going to be home testing kits. And they, of course, arrived and didn't work.
After several weeks away, Britain's Parliament is planning to restart proceedings next week, virtually. The proposed virtual Parliament, however, would limit the amount of parliamentary work that could take place, which has raised concerns among some members of Parliament about their ability to hold Boris Johnson's government accountable for its response to COVID-19. Daniel, why are some members of Parliament worried that they won't be able to hold Boris Johnson accountable over a virtual Parliament?
Well, this is in part a reflection of the unique dynamics within within the UK Parliament and the way that they're able to challenge their prime minister. But it's also reinforced by the way that Boris Johnson's personal health, as he has come out of the hospital, and this has become the kind of center of the story, has really, in some ways, obscured the larger policy questions for the United Kingdom.
What limits on parliamentary work have been outlined in the proposal?
You know, I'm not sure about the details of their return.
Let's move on to Canada. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responded to calls to reopen the economy at a press conference on Wednesday.
With spring coming, people are looking outside, wanting to get out, wanting this to be over. I understand that. It will be weeks more before we can seriously consider loosening the restrictions.
Trudeau also said on Thursday that the U.S.-Canada border would not be reopening to non-essential travel anytime soon, despite initial plans to reopen the border on April 19th. Emily, what's been Trudeau's response to the outbreak thus far?
Trudeau has gotten a lot of praise for his handling of the outbreak. I mean, both domestically, just because it's not as bad as it clearly is here, and also in that his wife got sick, and then he, you know, was with home with the kid, and also giving press conference, and so it was sort of played to Trudeau's strength as a politician as much as this pandemic can. I will also say that whatever you think of Trudeau, honestly telling the people that it is going to be weeks before they can safely reopen the economy is, you know, not to be subjective here, but that's the responsible thing to do. And yes, earlier estimations were made about when people could travel, when people could go back to work safely. They have been pushed back because reality has pushed them back. And I think that that's part of what people are looking for in their world leaders right now, is an honest assessment of the situation. And I should add that, you know, it's not just that it's nice outside. That's not the only reason that people in Canada or elsewhere want to go back to work.
Right.
Obviously, people are really suffering because of this.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I was reading through his statement and kind of was struck, not to be partisan about this, but was struck by the comparison between the way that he spoke about reopening the economy and the way that President Trump has spoken about reopening the economy here.
Well, speaking of President Trump, on Wednesday, President Trump said the U.S. and Canada are doing well and that that border would be one of the first to reopen. Why is there such a disconnect about a timeline? Dan?
So there is, this is characterized in some ways as the U.S. response throughout this crisis, both the eagerness of President Trump to get things back to normal and get the economy moving again, and also the kind of faltering coordination with allies both within North America and also with European allies and others. So Trump has shown great eagerness to, sometimes against the wishes of his public health officials, move back towards trade and commerce and some degree of normalcy much more quickly than other leaders have. And you've seen Trudeau be much more cautious, even as Trump has been much more eager to get the economy going again.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier this week, the Washington Post report that from Brazil to Afghanistan to El Salvador, it's not just local and central governments taking on the coronavirus. Armed groups like the Taliban and MS-13 are fighting back by distributing aid packages and enforcing lockdowns. Nina, this isn't new. Armed groups often look for ways to exploit crises, but how important are these non-state actors?
Well, it's a very good question. I think with any major crisis, as you say, comes opportunity, the opportunity to politicize, to galvanize your base, the opportunity to terrorize or simply run the show, especially in failing or failed states. I mean, the parallel is how the mafia evolved in southern Italy, and that's not just a historical point. Italian officials are warning right now that the mafia is stepping into coronavirus hot zones, offering their own loans, cash handouts, and trying to topple the grip of local authorities. I think that the point that the Post was making is that some of these terrorist groups and drug cartels are stepping in to run public health policy in some instances, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, and in places like Brazil, gangs have apparently been imposing curfews. I mean, what's very striking about Brazil, and this throws back to the point that you were making earlier, mm-hmm. which is that it's one of the so-called ostrich alliance countries that are whose leadership is burying their heads in the sand. Brazil, Nicaragua, Belarus, Turkmenistan, their leaders are coronavirus deniers. So, it's a significant development, definitely one that terrorist experts are now observing just how these groups are stepping into the space mm-hmm. left by coronavirus.
Dan, do we know if their efforts are different, more targeted? I wonder how much impact they can have in places that are pretty lawless.
Yeah, it's a reminder that, you know, in the West, in the United States, we often talk about these groups in terms of threats, but a big part of their success on the ground has always been the way that they provide order, where they step in where there's a security vacuum or a lack of public services. So, you know, this is the part of the success of the Taliban, of Hezbollah, of, you know, even of ISIS when it had its caliphate in Syria and Iraq. Mm-hmm. And organized crime, of course, operates similarly. So whenever there's no state, it's an opportunity for militants and criminals to take on those roles. And they have this kind of added opportunity here, as Nita pointed out, to play this kind of Robin Hood role. And that, again, is not anything new. It's been part of how both organized crime and militant groups have operated for a long time. But this really gives them a kind of high-profile opportunity to show that. And at a time when even states in the developing world, even in the U.S. and Europe, are really struggling to take control of the situation, if you imagine the pandemic really taking hold in some of these parts of the developing world where states are already weak, you can just imagine how difficult that situation will be and how much of an opportunity that presents to all kinds of armed actors, whether criminal groups or terrorists.
But what happened in El Salvador diverged from this a bit. Both the government and the powerful gang MS-13 instituted a curfew and a lockdown. Emily, are there other examples of armed groups and governments having the same message?
Yeah, I mean, you saw it. You've already mentioned Brazil. There were WhatsApp messages going around of sort of, you know, if the government won't step in, we will, which, again, provides order in a place where the government has decided that there doesn't need to be any because of the pandemic. I also think I thought it was really interesting, and this is slightly different from what we've been talking about, but that the Islamic State was pretty early on to issue a travel advisory to the EU. What that suggested to me was that these organizations were, in some cases, taking this more seriously than governments were, which, as Daniel, in my opinion, correctly said, it does give people a sense of not comfort exactly, but of safety and order that the people who were elected to provide that have failed to do.
Now, here's another story that we're following this week. China moved one of its ships into Vietnam's waters, and the U.S. State Department didn't like that. In a memo, it accused China of, quote, exploiting the distraction or vulnerability of other states to expand its unlawful claims in the South China Sea. Yes, that distraction is the coronavirus pandemic. And if the story sounds familiar, that's because something similar happened last year. Vietnam spent months trailing that same Chinese vessel as it moved about close to shore. Daniel, what's China up to?
So this is yet another reminder that geopolitics doesn't stop in a time of pandemic. It really accelerates. So this has been a game playing out in the South China Sea for a decade or more, with China laying claim to a huge portion of the sea and then the other Southeast Asian states around it vying for waters that they think they should have control over, either economically or access for military vessels. And China has been for some time throwing more and more of its own weight into claiming those waters. So in this case, it has sent a government survey ship with a number of Coast Guard vessels around it into waters that are claimed by Vietnam and Malaysia. And there is a standoff between the Chinese vessels and the Malaysian vessels. And this is something that China is going to continue doing in a time of pandemic or otherwise. And, you know, again, as a reminder that for all the talk of global leaders coming together and global ceasefires, this is, if anything, an opportunity to seize momentum and seize advantage.
Eric emails us and points out China has been doing this for decades. Is that true, Daniel?
That's right. And the activities have really ramped up over the last decade or two as China has become more powerful. But it has claimed these waters for several decades. And, you know, people talk about the nine-dash line, which indicates the Chinese claims in the South China Sea. So it has aspired to have this control for a long time. Now it has the power and the naval resources to really flex that power in a new way.
Nina, can you explain the importance of the South China Sea and why China cares about it so much?
Well, it's a complex question, and China has had those territorial aspirations for many, many years. I mean, I think to Dan's point about how this is likely to continue, I mean, what's very striking on a slightly different point, the GDP figures out today are showing that the Chinese economy has retreated by 6.8% in the first 3 months of the year because of the coronavirus. I suspect we won't see less spending on the military, and of course, you know, how much China spends on its military and its military aspirations is a contentious point. I think what's particularly interesting about the Chinese narrative right now is how it's hijacked the propaganda narrative with its own domestic audience. I mean, we saw at the very beginning of the crisis a great deal of public anger and outrage at the government for its handling of the crisis in Wuhan, demands for transparency, sympathy for the doctors and the whistleblowers, and that has really been turned on its head. And we're now seeing a public outrage by the foreign arrivals, foreign new cases. Of course, the borders have now closed to foreigners, but there's a great deal of mockery for the kind of West's ineptitude and apathy. So I don't think that that kind of nationalist support for expansion in the South China Sea is going to retreat anytime soon.
Now, we've been taking an outward look from the U.S., learning about what's going on in other countries. Let's take a moment to talk about how other countries learn about us. One of those ways is through Voice of America, or VOA, a government-funded agency that broadcasts news in 47 languages across the globe. In a memo sent out last Friday, the Trump administration accused VOA of, quote, amplifying Beijing's propaganda. The president continued the criticisms at Wednesday's press conference when he said that the, quote, things they say is disgusting towards our country. Nina Marie, what's behind those accusations?
Well, I mean, the explosion on Wednesday was startling, and without wanting to kind of editorialize, it did sound almost deranged. And I think there is a question of whether or not President Trump has gone too far. I think, you know, the problem for VOA is that it's not perhaps as widely or deeply appreciated within the U.S. It's a bit like the BBC World Service. And the public, you know, loves and knows NPR and PBS, but VOA's role in the world is perhaps underappreciated. Its charter, though, govern its independent coverage, and that is law. So the question of whether or not President Trump can tamper with VOA and turn it into, as I suspect he wants to do, his own propaganda channel overseas, mm-hmm. is a big question. I mean, he may be able to do that if he gets in for a second term. He wants to put in place, as the head of the agency overseeing VOA, a conservative filmmaker, Michael Pack, who's linked to Steve Bannon, and really, I think the only person standing in the way of President Trump tampering with VOA's independence is Amanda Bennett, who is a career journalist and who is single-handedly trying to protect the independence of VOA, whose history is deeply entwined with the history of America's influence overseas. And of course, the irony of all of this is that VOA itself has come under attack and suppression by hostile governments. Russia has pretty much blocked VOA. The Chinese, for a long time, have thought of VOA as a vehicle of the U.S. government. So it is, I think, for people not familiar, perhaps, with VOA's story and its role in the world, an extraordinary attempt by President Trump to shape VOA in his image.
Emily, can you talk about how you see this fitting in with Trump's attitude towards the media in general? Like, this was one of a number of attacks on the press this week, right?
Right. It fits into two things. One, it fits into his attacks on the media, which are ceaseless. But two, it sort of points out this l'état c'est moi attitude that Trump has, right? Because even though the Voice of America, some other countries don't like it, in part because it reports this very American. It does report out an American view of the world. In other countries, in different language services, it does take on an American edge in reporting those things. Mm-hmm. But that's not good enough, right? It has to be Trump's America. So it's both, yet again, while this agency is trying to bring news and information to people, as so many other media outlets are, an attack on the press, but it is also demonstrates that in his mind, not to psychoanalyze the president, but that in his mind there is a conflation or a belief that there should be a conflation between representing the United States and what's good for the United States and representing Trump and what's good for Trump.
We'd like to take a moment at the end of the news roundup to check with our journalists on what they're working on next. Nina, I know that you are working on some coverage from Russia this week. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, we have 34 bureaus globally. Russia is experiencing, well, first of all, under the Putin administration, a huge turnaround, a U-turn in its reaction and response to the spread of the virus. It's now got the highest rising rate of infections in the world. And I mean, I was just going to mention that as a news organization, as a television news organization, you know, we're grappling with, you know, migrating our news gathering to a completely different sort of beast. And, you know, we deal with teams in Delhi and Mumbai, trying to make sure that we're following safety precautions when we film. I mean, filming the world's biggest slum in Mumbai this week has been a challenge. And in Russia, where our journalists aren't allowed 100 meters outside their door unless they have a dog, you can imagine that some of that reporting is proving to be challenging, but it's also been, I think, important to bring a kind of global context. It's I think as a network of bureaus, all of our journalists are really trying to cover the ground that they need to cover.
Sounds good. Dan, 30 seconds. Tell us what's up with foreign affairs.
Yeah, if I can chill for the magazine for a second, we just put out an issue on climate change. Okay. And in some ways, this is an issue that is a little bit like global pandemics in that it is something that experts warn about for a long time, and it takes a real focus from the world to do something about it. I guess if we can end on an optimistic note, I would say there's at least a hope that the pandemic will remind us of why governments and institutions and people need to come together to counter these kinds of global problems, whether climate change or global health threats, before they hit and before they become crises.
And just with a few seconds to go, Emily, what's going on with you? This new role must have some...
Yes, exactly. Yes. I was just brought in to this new role. It's part of the New Statesman international expansion. So I'm sort of the U.S. editor / Washington correspondent. We have a new international homepage. There's a new World Review newsletter. So for readers of global news who have, or American news who have perhaps not checked out the New Statesman before, not to shill for my own publication, but I would highly encourage you to do that now.
My guests this week have been Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor for Foreign Affairs, and Nina Maria Potts, director of global news coverage for Feature Story News. Thank you all so much, and we do hope to see you again soon. Before we go, our last act of kindness for the week. Today's story comes from Deanna in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I'm a pet sitter in Charlotte, and since the coronavirus outbreak, I've lost about 90 to 95% of my business, but some of my very loyal and very kind clients have continued to pay me anyway, regardless of the fact that I'm not actually taking care of their pets at this time. It has helped me tremendously, and I will never forget their kindness. It's meant so much to me and my family during this really stressful time.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, Deanna. Now, if you have an act of kindness to share, we would love to hear from you, too. Our number, once again, it's 855-236-1212. It can be anything from a street parade with 6 feet of distancing between the marchers to a surprise birthday party over Zoom. We read and listen to every one of them. That number, again, is 855-236-1212. Our senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. The podcast is edited by Matthew Simonson. And a special shout out to our sound designer and engineer, Jake Cherry, who's been running today's entire show away from me from a safe social distance. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend. We hope you'll stay safe, and thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.